35 through 41. Mark 4, 35 through 41. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?"
If you didn't already know, I am preaching this morning. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and I'm sure many of you wonder what I'm doing right now or what we're up to since we've been back to Texas. So I'll share a little bit of that with you. We finished the internship here and we went to Alabama for a year. I was able to finish my bachelor's degree in May of last year. And, you know, through that whole time, I was looking and applying full-time ministry works. Wasn't able to find one, and I was really tired of being in Alabama. And so we decided we're just going to move back to Texas, be a little bit closer to family and relatives and things like that. So we moved back this past July. And Megan eventually found a job. We moved to New Braunfels, Texas, and Megan found a job working as a veterinary technician. After a few months, I found a job with a very interesting place. It's a private boarding school in San Marcos, and not a teacher or anything. I actually work in the boys' dormitory, and they have a mixture of day students and boarding students. The day students just go there during the day, and that's all they do. They go to school there during the day, and then the boarding students go to school, and they live on campus. So it allows for a lot of international students. In fact, we have a lot of Chinese students, South Korean students, Indian student, a few African students, things like that. I have various roles in my job working with those kids, or middle school to high school age. Part of it is just monitoring them, supervising, making sure they're getting where they need to go, not getting into trouble. Certainly there's elements of mentoring there, trying to build up a relationship with them, trying to help shape their and mold their character. But there's another part of my responsibilities, which is monitoring the entire campus, or a good portion of the campus. Basically, me and my other coworkers, we go out in 30-minute intervals, and we'll walk around the football field, walk around the school, the recreation center, walk around the dorms, just making sure that nobody shady's on campus, nobody's getting into, none of the kids are getting into anything that they're not supposed to get into. And because of that, we don't dress completely casual, but we wear comfortable clothing because we're going out and walking very often, so I'm able to wear cargo shorts and a polo shirt. Well, one day this past December, I walked outside, and it was probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was in the high 50s. And I was like, man, it's pretty comfortable out here. I don't think I'll need to bring anything like a jacket or anything, or jeans, to work. And so, and I start work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon after the kids get out of work. And so I just wore a polo shirt and some cargo shorts, and I got to work, and I went out on my first turn of monitoring the campus. And I started noticing the temperature was dropping a little bit. It was getting a little bit chilly, and I was like, well, it's probably not going to get too much worse. And you fast forward a few hours, and it's snowing on the ground, and it's like piles, several inches of snow piling up on the ground. There's kids behind the dorm getting on this hill trying to slide down it, trying to, like on a snow sled almost. And I live half an hour away from this campus, so I'm at work with no jacket, with no jeans, and I'm shivering, just cold in the lobby, and I'm just thinking, man, I hate Texas weather. So much. I hate Texas. There's so many things I love about Texas. When I was in Alabama, I missed Texas desperately. The one thing I did not miss is the sudden changes of weather, where you can be in 50, 60 degrees 1 hour, and then it's below freezing the next, and it's snowing on the ground. I hate those sudden weather changes in Texas. I imagine then if you lived in the northern part of Israel and you had to travel across the sea or the Lake of Galilee, you might have a similar disdain for that particular body of water. The lake there in Galilee, it's about 5 miles wide, 9 miles in length. It's not a huge body of water. But the geography of it was a little bit dangerous because it sort of sat in a bowl. I mean, you had the Sea of Galilee here at the bottom, and then these hills would come up over on the side. So it sat in this sort of bowl shape, I suppose, and the winds would come up, and then they would come over these mountains or hills, and they'd swoop down in the gorge, and they would make these sudden storms come about. It would just happen almost randomly, almost as suddenly as the weather changes in Texas. I mean, that's how quickly it would happen in the Sea of Galilee. And so many people who would try to fish on that body of water or travel across it were very nervous about shying away too far from the shore because they didn't know if just suddenly a storm could brew up, if the skies would start to darken, if the winds would start raging more and more, and then their life would be in danger because it could create these very intense storms. And so you see then in this story that we read for our scripture reading with Jesus and disciples going on this boat and trying to go across the Sea of Galilee, I want you to try and put yourself in this situation. I want you to put yourself in this story. Imagine you're one of the disciples. You're on the boat with Jesus. You're traveling across, and you start to notice that lightning start to span across the sky. You're noticing that the wind is starting to pick up in strength. You're noting that the waves are starting to become more intense and shaking the boat, and all of a sudden water's coming on board. It's coming on the deck, and you and the other disciples are starting to panic, and you're starting to worry. You grab buckets, and you're trying to scoop water off because you're trying to keep the boat from being overtaken. You're trying to keep it from capsizing. You don't want to die here this day. And then you start looking around, and you see all the other disciples with their buckets and trying to get water off, and then you look around, and you realize Jesus is not here helping us. Where is Jesus Christ? You remember that he was in the back of the boat sleeping before the storm came about, and so you walk to that back of the boat, and you go to that spot where you remember him sleeping, and you look in that spot, and you are very surprised at what you see. And we're going to take sort of a little bit of a different turn. We're going to take a little bit of liberty with what the story says, because we're going to change it up some, simply for the purpose of illustration, for the purpose of this lesson. You're going to go to the back of the boat, and you're not going to find Jesus sleeping there. There's going to be something else in his place, something different. And we'll walk through a few different scenarios where you find something each time. For example, here'd be the first one. You walk to the back of this boat. You look in that spot where you think Jesus is, and he's not there. Instead of Jesus sleeping, you find this giant pile of cash. Money. I mean, we're talking $100 bills, this big and this wide. It's the most money you've ever seen before. Maybe even if you have a nice job and you have a lot of money in your saving accounts, you've seen the number. You've seen a large number in your account, but you've never seen this much physical cash in front of you. I mean, you're partly shocked and you're confused about where Jesus is, but you're also a little bit happy that you found this. I mean, there's no other disciple that has mentioned bringing a big pile of cash on board, or nobody that's laid claim to it. So as far as you know, finders keepers, right? And you start to run through your mind. You think about, well, where did this money come from? How did it get here? I wonder how much this is. It must be in the millions. I mean, this is a lot of money. And then that thought process gives way to you starting to imagine all of the possibilities of what you can do with this money. I could pay off all my debt. Every credit card, every student loan, every mortgage payment. I could buy a house in straight cash, a really nice house if I wanted to. My kids can go to college and they never have to take out a student loan. I could pay for it completely, out of pocket. Well, I could take care of my aging mother and father who need 24-hour assistance. and that won't burden me financially. I can provide for them as much as they need. You think of all those vacations I've ever wanted to take, all those places I ever wanted to go, it's at my fingertips now. I can go to any state, I can go to any coast, I can go to any country that I've ever wanted to go. It's amazing the things you start to think about. And as you're imagining all these possibilities and these amazing things, the boat shakes and you're nearly knocked off of your feet. Then you're back in the life-threatening scenario again. And you realize, oh yeah, the storm could take my life. As nice as all this money is here and all the things I could do with it, in reality, if I don't survive, it means nothing. If I don't escape this storm, it means nothing. And you go back out and on the main part of the boat, and you still see the disciples trying to scoop out water, and each time they scoop some water out, twice as much more gets dumped onto the deck because of the waves. And you realize, this money, it can't save me. This money cannot be used to bribe the storm to stop, to cease. This money cannot cry out, "Peace, be still." This money can't save me from the storm. What then would be the illustration? What's the point of this, of what we're discussing, this hypothetical situation? Well, I think it's a very simple one. Let's not replace Jesus with money. And let's not replace Jesus with the pursuit of money. Let's not replace Jesus with the fantasy about money. Let's not assume that money can save us from any storm that comes about. That it can overcome and calm any treacherous storm that is going to be brought upon us in our life, because truthfully, it can't. And it won't. And I think as Christians, you know, we ought to be very good stewards of our money. We should have that incentive to be responsible financial individuals. And if we are, then it often will lead to us being very successful, maybe even very wealthy. And there's nothing wrong with that. Yes. I'm happy for I'm glad that the church has Christians who do have money and who are very responsible, and at the same time, they're not greedy. I think that's a very good thing, and it's something we should all should strive for. But we also need to take care, and as much as we try to plan for retirement and pay off debt and try to save and put money away and try to grow our wealth, we should probably be careful not to assume that that money can save us from any scenario, that it's always going to be consistent. In James chapter 4, verse 13, James writes to the disciples there, to very wealthy Christians. He says, you've got all these plans. You plan to go to this city, and you plan to go and start this business, and you plan to make this much capital and this much gain and this and that. And he says, you need to take a step back and say, if the Lord wills, then I will do those things. Then I will go and pursue those financial endeavors, because truthfully, your life, like a vapor, appears for a little while and then it vanishes away. I think James's point there was to say that, you know, you may not be even around to pursue this wealth that you're planning to go after. But even another point, it's not just that we ourselves are like a vapor that appears for a while and it vanishes away. Money is the same way. Money is not constant. It is not consistent. The bank account does not always have money coming into it like we expect every single week or every single month. Things come up. Expenses arise. Even Jesus himself said, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on the earth. Moth and rust corrupt. Thieves, they break through and steal. You can lose that money. You can have your identity stolen. You can be put in a position where you have to file for bankruptcy. Somebody can, for whatever reason, try to sue you and take you for all that you have. Money is not consistent. Money cannot be trusted, and money just can't save us from every storm that could come about. I think it was in the 1930s after the Great Depression that you had the stock market crash. The country was in economic crisis, and at that point in time, the national suicide rate in the country increased by 20%. Now, I'm certainly not going to pass judgment on all those individuals who might be included in that category. I don't know them. I'm sure that it was a very desperate situation. People lost their homes, their businesses, their livelihood. But I think it would be maybe a reasonable guess to say that probably a lot of people had put too much trust in their money and not enough trust in Jesus. They thought that it could save them and survive them from any storm, which it really couldn't. But you go on this boat, and you're looking for Jesus. You've been scooping water off the side of the boat. You're trying to survive this storm. And you go to the back of the boat, and you're trying to find where Jesus was. And you go to this spot, and you don't see him there. But it's also this time, you're not seeing a pile of money there. There's something different, something actually much more small. You actually go in that spot, and you find this little card sitting there. And so you pick it up, and you see there's some writing on this card, and something printed on there seems to be the place that you work, your place of business. The place that you are employed at, you have the name of that business, you have the contact information, the address, the email, and whatnot. And below that, you have your name. You have your job title, and whatever that might be, your job title, whatever you are called or your position is at the place that you work, and your contact information. You realize, this is my business card. This represents my title, my status of working, my status of the place where I work. I'd say then this represents not simply money, but this represents our job and our pursuit of jobs and our pursuit of careers. And I would say then from that illustration, we should not replace Jesus with our work. We should not replace Jesus with the pursuit of our careers. And I think this is important to distinguish from the first illustration, from the pursuit of money, because working is not always about trying to get wealthy. I think, yes, that is a main drive for why we work. We don't want to work for free. But it's not just to get ahead. I think our occupations mean a lot more to us and to how the world looks at us and to how we look at ourselves. You think about when you meet a new person, one of the first things that you ask, among the many questions, you know, what is your name? Where are you from? Well, you know, maybe somebody who's visiting here this morning. What brought you here? You get to talking to them a little bit more. One of the things you eventually get around to is, what do you do for a living? Where is it that you work? What is your job status? What is your job title? Well, you know, that's one of the things that we feel like defines us. It's certainly how we often socially define ourselves. But even our own personal self-esteem, again, we're not just working to get money. We want to work in a job, in an occupation that we think matters, that we think is significant, we think it's important. It's part of how we feel we define ourselves. It was just a week or two ago, I was talking to one of these students that goes to the school that I'm working at. He's a senior in high school. He's from Africa, and his father is like the CEO of this international company that builds oil rigs. Like, they actually construct the oil rigs. It's a really big business. And we're talking to him, you know, we said, what do you want to do when you graduate from here, when you graduate high school? And he said, well, I'm going to go off to college, eventually, you know, get my bachelor's degree, and I have to get two master's degrees in engineering. And he said, you know, it'll cost a lot of money, it'll be a lot of work, but I have to get two master's degrees. But once I do that, I will be eligible to inherit 60% of my father's company. So 60%, he'd be a majority holder of that company. And so I said, well, you know, how much, if you had that right now, how much would it be worth? And he said, well, roughly in American dollars, it'd be about $200 to $250 million. And that kid is set for life. I mean, it's, at least it seems that way. That's a lot of money. I had another coworker sitting by me listening to this, and he said, man, if I was going to inherit all of that company, as soon as I got all that stock, I would immediately sell it, I'd take all the cash, and I would retire in my 20s, and I'd never work again. So I'd be going on vacations, and I'd be doing this and that, and I sat back and listened to him, and I said, well, you know, that'd be nice for a little while. It'd be nice going on vacations and things like that and not having to worry and stress about money. But I think eventually if you stop working, it'd probably get just a little bit boring. You might lose a little bit of sense of yourself and your self-purpose and your drive. I think that, you know, a lot of people who get to a point of the age where they can retire, or even just financially they're at a point where they can retire. Sometimes they don't actually retire. And you may be sitting there thinking, well, once I retire, I'm done. Well, maybe. Probably so. But there are lots of individuals who get to the point where they can retire and they still keep working. And the reason why is because their sense of self-identity and their sense of self-worth is partially tied into this. Their job, their title, and their status. And to a certain degree, like I said, I think that's normal and that's appropriate. And the Bible says we should be people who work. If a man who shall not work, he shall not eat. But at the same time, we ought not to replace the pursuit of a career, the pursuit of climbing up that ladder, the pursuit of advancing this, and replace it with Jesus. For some of the same reasons that we talked about with money, the reality is jobs are not always stable across the lifespan. The economy, that can easily crash. Jobs can get tight. They can let people go. You can have layoffs. Sometimes when you stand up for truth and righteousness, it means you might lose your job. It means because you've done the right thing, your boss might say, that's not what I wanted to do, so I'm going to let you go. That happens. It's a very real truth, a very real reality. Work relationships are not always stable. When I was going here for my internship, I was doing the Fishers of Men course, and I was required to have Bible studies with people or set up studies. And I couldn't find one. And Megan was so nice to help me out. She was working at a vet clinic over at Davis Boulevard. And she asked one of her coworkers to study with me, and she said yes. It was an older woman in her 50s, and she, you know, had some Bible studies with me. It went very well, and she actually grew in a close bond with Megan. And the problem was she was not a very good worker, and Megan got put in charge of anonymously evaluating her work performance, and it wasn't a very good evaluation, unfortunately, and she reported that to her boss, and this woman got let go. And sad to say, that was the last time we ever studied the Bible with her or had a, you know, relationship with her. She was very angry. She was very upset at Megan, and you know, Megan was struggling with that because, you know, she didn't want to ruin the chances to try to teach this woman the gospel. But I said, you know, you have a duty in your job, and you have to do what's right and appropriate. And it cost her a work relationship with this woman because of that. Sometimes when you do what's right, it can put your job at risk. Sometimes when you do what's right, you may not have that dream career that you've always wanted. Let's not replace Jesus with this. Our jobs are not always going to be there to save us from any storm. You're on a boat and you're scooping water out. You're trying to survive. You're trying to stay alive. And you go to the back of this boat. You try to go to that spot to find Jesus. And you don't find him there, but this is maybe the most interesting thing you find. It's not a pile of cash. It's not a business card. You actually find a person here. It's not Jesus. It is your spouse. The person you love and care about most on this earth, it is your spouse sitting there, and you are taken back, you are surprised because you did not even know that they were on the ship. You didn't even know that they came to travel with you. But immediately you see them, you don't ask, what are you doing here? You hug them, you embrace them. I'm so happy to see you. I'm so glad you're here. Now you can help us. And that spouse says, yes, I will come and help you. And they grab a bucket, and they go, and they're scooping water that's coming up past the shins, and they're trying to get it off the boat. And you're so excited at first, and you have an extra hand, and you have that emotional support for that individual being with you there, and it warms your heart. But eventually, your spouse's arms start to get tired, the body starts to get weak, and they're not very effective in helping get in the water off the boat. And eventually, you start to realize and become discouraged because even your spouse cannot save you from this storm. Even with their assistance, they can't cry out, peace be still, and stop the winds and the seas. We shouldn't replace Jesus with money. We shouldn't replace Jesus with our pursuit of a career, but we also shouldn't replace Jesus with our spouse or parents or our children or our siblings or our best friend, really any human relationship, we ought not to replace Jesus with any other person in our lives. A couple reasons why. One of them I want you to see in Psalm 146. Psalm 146. Psalm 146, beginning in verse 3, it says, "Put not your trust in princes, nor in the son of man, in whom there is no help. His breath goes forth, he returns to his earth, in that very day his thoughts perish. Happy is he that hath the God of Jacob for his help, whose hope is in the Lord his God." The psalmist says, don't trust in princes, don't trust in the son of man, don't trust in all these humans to help you through the storm. Now, he's not saying this because he says all humans are evil and wicked and they will always betray you, they'll turn their backs on you. That's not his point here. He says don't trust in men, don't trust in the Son of Man because they are impermanent. Because they simply don't last forever. The truth is you could have the most faithful and righteous and godly spouse, and the best husband, the best wife there ever is. But they don't last forever. They are not eternal in the sense of this life. They have a soul that will last forever, but their life here will not last forever. And sometimes we may put so much stock in that person that we seem to trust them more than we trust Jesus. That we assume they're always going to be there to help us. They'll help us survive the storm. They'll help us through any tribulation, but they may not always be there. I wonder if our spouse, if our parents, if our child, if our best friend, if they were no longer here, would we still be a Christian? If they were no longer here, would we still be a part of God's church? If they were no longer here, would we care about God's word? If they were no longer here, would God even matter to us? Would I even pray? Do they make a difference? People don't last forever. I'm thankful my sister this last weekend she had an accident because she hit a cow. She was driving at night and she driving on a very dark lit road, but it was still technically a highway and there was no lights around, and she was going about 55 miles an hour. She hit at night a black cow, and she hit it on the back end of it, on the hind part of it, and it. After a minute or two later, after she hit the cow, somebody came and hit her on the back part of the car. And I'm very grateful that she did not have any serious injuries. She had a bump on the head and she had some burns from the airbag. But she could have been hurt a lot worse. I think I'm amazed that she actually even survived with her life, because that could have been so much more deadly. But I asked the question, when I still trust in God if she was no longer here? Would that tragedy, would that storm break my faith in God? It shouldn't. It'd be devastating. It'd be emotionally overwhelming. I would have such a difficult time trying to cope with that, and it would bother me for so many years for the rest of my life. But I think the question is, do we have more trust, more stock in a person who is impermanent than we do in a Lord who is eternal? In a Lord who can cry out, "Peace be still." You shouldn't put your full trust in people, again, not just because they are impermanent, but also because even just relationships in general can be very unstable. They don't always last forever. You think about that individual who you used to be close to, and maybe you're no longer close to them. Maybe now there's some bad blood. Maybe now you don't have a good relationship with them. I wonder what went wrong. Maybe they had a bad attitude. Maybe you had a bad attitude. Maybe it was both of you. But there are scenarios in life that we don't always anticipate, we don't always expect, but it can drastically change the nature of our relationships. A brother and sister who grew up as best friends and they loved each other. Now their parents have aged and they have passed away. And for a year, that brother and sister are fighting over who gets what from mom and dad's estate. There's a couple who a man or woman who've been together in a relationship for 10 years. And they got married and they were in love. And then they found out they were struggling with infertility. And now the husband and wife are at a debate about whether to adopt a child. And it is putting a strain on their marriage. It has nothing to do with any one of them being moral or immoral. It is challenging. It is devastating to them, though. A woman lies in a coma, and her outlook is not good. She's probably not going to wake from it. And the husband is debating with his in-laws about whether or not to let his wife die with dignity, or to be put out of her misery and to not leave her in that coma. These are real situations that can happen, real scenarios that can come up in life, and that they can change the nature of our relationships, the people we are closest to. If we have too much trust in everyone else, a storm's going to come, and we're going to realize they can't save us. They can't defeat that storm. They can't overcome that storm. We need Jesus, and only Jesus. During the flood of Noah's day, there was the waters started coming down and started rising above the earth and the land, and there was only one boat that was going to save them. Only one. And even if at that time that other people might have had smaller boats or vessels that they might have used to travel across bodies of water or rivers, if they tried to use that during the flood, they were putting trust in a wrong boat. They were putting trust in a boat that was not backed or was not supported by God, and they would have been consumed by the seas and would have been consumed by the waters. They would not have been survived. They would not have survived. Today, there is no boat to trust in except the one that Jesus is on. There is no boat that we can survive the storm in except the one that Jesus is in, the one that he can be there to cry out, "Peace, be still," when any storm arises. Walking around, living in my sin, not being baptized, not repenting of what I've done, we're in a boat without Jesus. Living for just the pursuit of money and the pursuit of a career and the pursuit of higher status in society with neglect of God's church or God's kingdom or God's word, we might be in a boat without Jesus. Living for my spouse, living for my parents, living for simply my children. Not that I don't love and care about those individuals, but when they matter more to me than God, friends, we might be in a boat without Jesus. We don't want to wait to find out when a storm comes. We don't want to wait to find out when the seas start to rage, when the wind starts to pick up, when the rain starts coming down. Those tragedies are going to come in life. We don't want to wait till then to find out if Jesus is there with us. So I'd simply ask you, is Jesus on the boat with you? Jay Brown. Let's stand and sing.